Thank you for coming. This is my first time participating in a Berkman event, and so far so good. The food is really good, so I would come back. It's especially nice to be introduced by Jean, because Jean and I were roommates here as undergrads, when a lot of, I think, both of our interests in these topics were not quite forming, but percolating a little under the surface. And I guess you guys probably know the format better than I do, but I'll speak for 10 to 20 minutes, and then hopefully we'll have lots of conversation and discussion, which I'm looking forward to just listening, because the way some of these issues relate to what goes on today will be something that many of you have ideas and thoughts and experiences that I don't. So I know I can learn a lot from everyone here. But I will focus on the 19th century, so we'll rewind a bit and think about the way the battles over copyright existed within the literary communities and the literary voices back then. So I thought I would start with the motto for the American Copyright League. The American Copyright League was one of many clubs and associations that formed in the 19th century, consisting mostly of authors, but also other people interested in issues related to writing and publishing. So that would include publishers. And they weren't that different, as I said in my description that I think was emailed around, from the Berkman Center. That is, they were associations of people not necessarily who agreed about everything, and we'll see that a little bit in this talk, but who wanted to rethink and reshape how we think about intellectual property, and in this case, literary property. So they actually had a motto. I don't know if the Berkman Center has a motto, do they? but they did have a motto for the American Copyright League, which formed in the 1880s, which was written by James Russell Lowell, a name that many of us wouldn't recognize or wouldn't know quite who it was, but one of the most famous poets in the 19th century, and the president of the American Copyright League. They actually published the motto in a magazine, Century Magazine, in his handwriting. So it's a little poem, and anyone who wants to see this can. I, of course, didn't do a PowerPoint presentation or anything like that, because I'm not very technological. So here's Lowell's little poem that becomes the motto for the Copyright League. In vain we call old notions fudge and bend our conscience to our dealing. The Ten Commandments will not budge, and stealing will continue stealing. Maybe not Lowell's best poem. So don't get the wrong idea. If you don't let it dissuade you from reading more James Russell Lowell. But what it did give them was a voice in verse, a voice in a literary format, confronting this issue. That is, confronting the issue of theft and lack of protection in the copyright regime. And this was quoted constantly in discussions about copyright. This really became a mantra for the advocates of copyright. Part of what's interesting about it is the way it's invoking a higher authority, a moral authority, or even a biblical authority in this case. And we spoke about this in my seminar class on this topic. The Ten Commandments will not budge. So the idea is that this verse for this copyright association that's actually calling for major changes in the copyright regime is invoking some indefinite past, almost a traditionalist return. So in vain we call old notions fudge. What Lowell is telling us is there was a time before the present in this case being 1885, when we would have respected property, literary property to be specific, more than we do now. Instead, what we do is bend our conscience to our dealing. In other words, that business practices and money concerns take the upper hand over morality. So we're trying to create change, And in doing so, we're invoking some distant, indefinitely distant past in which property was respected. So we'll unpack that a little bit, but a broader scope. The fight for a new copyright regime went on pretty much the whole 19th century. 1891 is when things change. It does have peaks and valleys. So the 1830s and the 1880s, I'd say, are the most active period. And during the Civil War, we're obviously focused on other things rather than on our copyright disputes. And it was the active periods that really led us to the formation of these copyright associations, these copyright clubs, these leagues, which had varying degrees of coherence and membership and unanimity. And we often saw petitions going around with the names of many famous writers. So, for instance, this was a letter to the House of Representatives signed by James Fenimore Cooper and William C. Bryant that I also is in handwriting if anyone wants to see it afterwards. And we had a big list of names send out a memorial of American authors, and we see signatures from Louisa May Alcott and Mark Twain, William Dean Howells, Oliver Wendell Holmes. So there was a very careful and coordinated effort to use the literary fame of our writers to promote the conversation about literary property, and really put those voices at the forefront of the debate. And we'll see why that's important. So what exactly was going on? Because we're concerned with, or we know much more obviously about our own copyright laws than we would about the middle of the 19th century. There was copyright. If you were to be a published writer in the United States, you would have copyright protections that look more or less like ours, not exactly. What there wasn't any protection for was international circulation of literary properties. So the United States had not agreed to any international copyright treaties or agreements. And what this would mean is that British authors, that's who we would be mainly concerned with because they're writing in our language, could not get copyright protection here. Now, the ramifications of this are actually much bigger than they might at first appear when you hear it. This would mean that publishers in the United States could publish British authors without paying a cent to any of the authors. So this would, of course, harm our British authors, our Dickens and Matthew Arnolds and Anthony Trollope's, because they're not getting any royalties. And people like Dickens sold enormous amounts of books here. But it also undermined several generations of American authors, because you'd walk into a bookstore and you had your choice between a Dickens book for 25 cents and a Mark Twain book for $1 or $1.25, which will you buy? The Dickens book. So not just the British authors, but the American authors were infuriated by this. And really what was at stake was whether there could be a profession of author, whether as an author you can make your living from writing books. So all of the authors were harmed by this, and this was the crisis. We had drawn copyright around a map. We had made a geographical map of copyright. Lowell's little poem that we heard at the beginning was not the only attempt at turning intellectual property anxieties and concerns into poetry, whether it's effective poetry or not. In fact, my class this semester started with two poems our first day of class, a Rudyard Kipling poem called The Rime of the Three Captains, in which he's retelling the theft of one of his books by an American publisher, Harper. Harper, which is now HarperCollins, started as Harper Brothers and then became Harper Row. Harper was the most notorious and proud of pirate publishing. So they beat everyone. And Rudyard Kipling was very upset, and he did a quite long and complicated poem about or rather literalizing the metaphor of pirate and giving us a poem about a pirate that is plundering innocent British ships. And we even get this line, this very, very serious line, straight-faced line, "Does he steal with tears when he buccaneers?" For God, then, why does he steal? So there's the moral question here, and there's also a narrative being created around this criticism of pirates and buccaneers, or as one of the copyright writers said, buccaneers. The sense of this theft, of theft being constant and instantaneous and expected, is something we see all over the map of literature. So a famous example of a story that you can discover this in would be Edgar Allan Poe's The Purloined Letter, right? In which the theft of what you write is instant and public. So the big creative solution in this, one of the first detective stories in history, is that the stolen letter is in public view the whole time, but no one noticed it. So this is the very unique way in which intellectual property theft occurs. It's something being stolen, but it only matters if it's also something in the public view. There was another interesting incident that sort of echoes the Purloined Letter when Dickens comes to America. So Dickens comes to America twice on two big book tours. He more or less created the book tour. And when he first comes, he actually meets Poe, and we don't know exactly what happened in that meeting, although they were very upset with each other, and people think they spoke about copyright and had some kind of argument. We don't have any record of what they said. While Dickens is here, he champions international copyright because, again, he's losing countless amount of money by not being protected by our copyright regime. In fact, he called himself the biggest loser in America by the lack of copyright. And there's a letter printed by Dickens in a newspaper about copyright. It's a forgery, even though Dickens was advocating for copyright. So we have this weird merger of these themes when a forgery of a Dickens letter is published about copyright, even though Dickens is going around speaking about it. And who publishes it? It's Walt Whitman in the New York newspaper that he's editing. And he's sort of sympathetic to this forged letter, but Dickens is very upset. So we have all of these false literary identities circulating. And when Dickens leaves America, Americans are very upset with him. They think he just came for the reason of trying to get copyright. It was just a mercenary mission. He writes a book that we're looking at in our class in a few hours called Martin Chuzzlewit, about the false commerce in America, about an unstable American experience with commerce. So we have these pirates circulating through literature. We have these tricks and these forgeries circulating through literatures, in part all stemming from the problems and the anxieties, the moral anxieties, the professional anxieties that come from not having our copyright set up in a way that that transcends our own geographical boundaries. This also becomes an interpretive strategy for those wishing to frame or reframe literary property disputes. For instance, Harriet Beecher Stowe. When she writes Uncle Tom's Cabin, it becomes one of the biggest bestsellers in history, if not the biggest at that point. And it's translated into German without her permission here in the United States. She sues in court. She loses because the judge rules that a translation is a different entity than the original text. Putting aside that case, which is interesting and complicated, another interesting part of it is the response to Harriet Beecher Stowe having sued to protect her copyright, which is the criticism that here she is writing a novel that is decrying the fact that we make slaves property, and yet she's trying to protect her literary property. So the idea that Harriet Beecher Stowe is a hypocrite because there's this analogy between slavery and copyright completely falls on deaf ears to us. It's something that sounds very strange, whereas some of the other arguments sound very familiar to what we talk about today. So all of these authors are harmed pretty equally, who are publishing books. So the footnote here is that journalists are not necessarily harmed in the same way. In fact, journalists are taking advantage of the fact that they could publish and republish at will foreign texts, right? Their entire newspapers, one was called Brother Jonathan, these very large newspapers that subsisted on publishing novels from England. At the same time that they would often criticize it in the column next to the novel. So even though all the authors publishing books are damaged by this regime, it doesn't mean there was a unanimous approach here. So within the battle to change copyright, we have conflicts and we have tentativeness with these authors. So authors like Walt Whitman, Mark Twain, James Fenimore Cooper, they're supporting copyright, but they're tentative about it. We have a really interesting transcript of the Senate testimonies when the authors come to the Senate to try to get a new copyright law. And my students saw this. Mark Twain is has a very odd place in this testimony. He comes to testify, and then they can't get him to testify, and they have to sort of push him to testify. You see this in the exchanges with the senator and with the other writers. There's lots of reasons for this, why the authors were tiptoeing a bit at certain times. I won't get into all of them, but one was at the same time they were advocating for authors and for themselves as authors, they didn't want to be seen as crushing the laborers. So there was a divide forming between the manufacturers of books, the printers and the bookbinders and the typesetters, and the authors, because what will happen in the fear of those laborers, if we open up international copyright, is that books will be made somewhere else and will have copyright protection here, so that they're harmed. Also, these printers are making a lot of money by being able to print freely the British text in cheap editions. So this is when we first start getting cheap editions of books. It's something, again, that we don't quite think about as much. But the transition from having library editions for private library collections and having cheap editions that would be sold, for instance, in the railroad stations was a major transition. So we have this divide that people like Mark Twain and Walt Whitman were very tentative about, looking like they're crushing the laborers, they're crushing the manufacturers. Read Leaves of Grass. Walt Whitman does not want to be positioning himself as some elitist author that is above those making the book. This is also something from hundreds of years before that was being sorted out. That is, in the 18th century, we're still really deciding, is the author, and the century before that, is the author different from the physical makers of the book? That is, our conception of the author having such a different position than the bookbinder or the typesetter is something relatively modern. Right. So this is something that our authors are very worried about. They're worried about looking greedy, just like we say, well, Aerosmith is complaining about us downloading music on Napster from their private jet. Same thing was being said about Dickens, about Cooper. Cooper was very nervous about this. Cooper would often say, he would lie sometimes and say, oh, I didn't sign this petition, the petition I have here. I didn't sign that. I wouldn't sign that even if I saw that. Because they were making a lot of money for that moment in time, Mark Twain also. And Dickens was just brushed over the coals for the temerity of demanding copyright when he was making so much money. Dickens would come here, he would leave after a couple of months, he would have made $100,000 on his speaking tours. People were very upset about this. So there's a democratic versus aristocratic value fight here going on around copyright. So is it more democratic to allow copyright to protect authors from other countries? Or is it more democratic, for instance, one argument, that poor Americans can buy books cheaply and become better educated? This was a major argument. And we can change the books. This was, again, something that doesn't ring true to our ear, or doesn't ring at all convincing to our ear, was the argument that, well, wait a minute, we don't want copyright because we need to be able to change British texts to be more American. We need to make them more in tune with American values, right? So there was constant worry about Americans reading too much of the old English romances of the castles and the kings and the queens of the aristocratic romantic values, right? Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, which we read in our class this semester, what is it? It's an American invading that world, right? The world of kings and queens, and changing it, transforming it, in the end, destroying it. So these were concerns that were circling and coming to sort of a culmination. So what I'll close off here is just to point out something that I find most interesting about all this, which sort of fast forwards ahead of where we are in class so far, so the students that are here will get a preview, which is all this is sort of a fictional narrative being superimposed on the actual legal regime by the writers. In other words, one of the things that's really fun about teaching this class, and I hope that the students are having fun, is these are writers that are so concerned with this issue, and you can see how careful they are in the language. And they're careful with the rhetoric, they're careful with the narrative. What I mean by that is they're superimposing a narrative of textual ownership and natural rights. Remember that Ten Commandment allusion in the James Russell Lowell poem? This was not something that was accepted, necessarily, that authors had their natural right to their literary property. And a narrative of pirates and robbers and thieves on a legal regime where that actually didn't exist. Our court said we don't have a common law right, necessarily, to our literary property. And also, guess what? The pirates, Harper, all of these cheap reprinters were doing nothing wrong. There was no law against it. The reason they became pirates is because that's what we put into our rhetoric and into our poems and into our stories, converting them into pirates and robbers and thieves until the point where we believed it. But in fact, they were completely acting within the law. We weren't protecting the British writers. So someone reprinting them is not breaking the law. All of this gradually sort of wore down the paradigm of a collective ownership of these texts and replaced it, made the rhetoric real, or literalized the rhetoric, with the narrative of piracy and triumph against the thieves, triumph against the robbers, against that pirate that Rudyard Kipling is imagining as corrupting and stealing his book. And one of his complaints was that they were changing his text or not allowing the text to be what he wanted it to be. So all this worked because the rhetoric was so strong. And because it worked, it's easy for us to forget from our vantage point that there was this need to craft the rhetoric at one point, that there was this need to change things so much from the way we understand it now, to create, in a way, a shadow copyright regime. Because that's easy to forget, I think it's also easy not to notice how we do it or how our society does it. That is, how we adjust the rhetoric and manipulate the rhetoric carefully, for better or for worse, in the popular conception of ownership and of copyright and of protection, in some cases protection that actually isn't there. Some examples that would pop into my head, the FBI warning in front of our movies, in front of our DVDs, right? Which somehow seems to forget any concepts of fair use, but most people would never question it, right? It's a very intimidating and strong rhetoric. Gene mentioned I did work in law school on animation property rights, so I happen to know that, for instance, there was a big deal in the news recently, last year, where Walt Disney purchased back Oswald the Rabbit. Oswald the Rabbit was the forerunner of Mickey Mouse. And when Walt Disney lost the rights to Oswald the Rabbit, they had to create Mickey Mouse to replace him. Recently, Disney purchased the copyright back to Oswald the Rabbit from Columbia, Universal. So because I have this random knowledge of it, I know that actually Columbia, who used to own Oswald the Rabbit, never renewed Oswald the Rabbit's first three cartoons. Once the first appearance of a character falls into the public domain, that character falls into the public domain. Disney knows that. That's what they were worried about with Mickey Mouse, that as soon as the first Mickey Mouse cartoon would fall into the public domain, the character would fall into the public domain. But they're just pretending that this copyright still exists, and it's in press releases and it's in articles, and we accept it. It's the rhetoric. They shape the narrative. Google Books, they're transforming the books as they scan them. Maybe they are and maybe they aren't. I think it's sort of a suspect legal argument, but in the end it probably won't matter because the pressure that exists on publishers to agree to the Google Books format is so strong that publishers will agree to it, and that rhetoric probably will take over. The books are transformed by Google doing this, and thus they own them in a different way. So all these things might be for the good or they might be for the bad, but I guess what interests me is the way we're converting the rhetoric to change the actual copyright regime. So those were what I was going to say, and I hope it didn't go too long, but all of you would have examples or thoughts on the way this works today that are probably much more sophisticated than mine. So I'm happy to sort of open up the conversation if we still have the time. Yeah.
That was great. I just have a question. Was there a moral argument in favor of not having international copyright protection?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I mentioned, one, there was the moral argument that education was crucial to the American culture, and that...
But that would also be an argument for making American works uncopyrighted.
Yeah, exactly. So all of these arguments sort of worked in both directions or had big holes in them, depending on where you put them. The main arguments were related to protecting the workers and the laborers, that if we allowed British authors to have the same rights that American authors, we'd be sacrificing our working class. So those were, I think, the arguments that got the most sympathy from people. But in the end, the two groups sort of worked together. Yeah, you're right. The pure moral arguments would have had to also attack American copyright. And we were already established enough in that track that I don't think many people were doing that. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Either we could start in the back and then...
What was the logical argument for, you know, why should the author be protected one place and not another? They produce the same good, and originally when the law of copyright was instituted by Congress,
right?
What was the logic under the, if it's the good produced here, then it's protected. If the good produced over there, then it's not.
Well, I mean, I think this is partially a product of a different sense of boundaries, right? I mean, we have a very different sense of sort of a globalized world and information being able to travel easily and quickly and accurately. But this was really, I think there wasn't an ideology that I think would make sense to us. The argument was that if the book isn't being produced here by an American, why should American laws honor it? So there wasn't the sense of, there wasn't anything that you had to disprove about an international protection because it didn't exist in our framework, in our ethos.
Do laws apply to other goods besides books?
Well, tariffs were sort of set up to keep things out, right? And I mean, it's slightly different, but Walt Whitman, actually, there's a funny story that his Leaves of Grass was published in England and he couldn't get any royalties from it because there was no reciprocity with England with copyright. And he asked the British publisher, he said, please just send me a copy. I just want to see a British copy. And he got his copy from England of Leaves of Grass and had to pay $3 for the tariff tax once he received it. So it was the other direction as well. In other words, England wasn't honoring American copyrights, although they were starting to honor other countries. So it was really a stalemate between England and the U.S. There was no alternative that existed sort of before that. All of these things were fairly sort of growing, emerging concepts in terms of whether there was any right to protect. So I think maybe you're looking for why, what the argument would be against the natural right.
Yeah, so
the natural right wasn't something that we, that many people were really embracing. You know, that was part of the change in rhetoric, but you know, what one copyright advocate put it this way, that this isn't copyright, this is copy privilege. So remember, copyright started as a right for a printer or an entity like a printer to print copies. It had nothing to do with any profound natural right. That was something that evolved. Even though the word right in our Constitution only appears in our provision about copyright, I mean, until the Bill of Rights, of course. That's the only place it appears, but it's not phrased in a way that's really relying on any kind of natural right.
You may or may not be aware, but there's a branch of sort of copyright reform, mostly in the developing world, that tries to make an access to knowledge argument for access to educational material sort of coming back to this time in American copyright history. And the argument basically goes, I'm in India, I couldn't possibly go to university if I actually paid for textbooks, so I use pirated textbooks to go to university, and this is something that makes sense for developing nations. And in fact, look at America when it was a developing nation, it violated British copyright left and right, it's just appropriate that India and China and other developing nations do so at this point. What is your read on how sort of Twain et al. Would have responded to this argument if put forward to them sort of in the time period you're talking about?
Well, Twain was a little bit all over the place with this issue, but I mean that's really interesting, and I didn't know that.
To tell you more about it offline.
But was being used, yeah. I mean that was being used as an argument. That's terrific, and it's even something that maybe one of my students would want to work on in their paper to sort of look at.
Happy
those
to put you in touch. Lawrence Liang is mm-hmm. the guy you want to talk to, who is a legal scholar in Calcutta.
Okay.
And is putting forth your argument.
Yeah, that's. You know, this is definitely something that people thought about in the 19th century, which was we didn't have a national literature. America wasn't happy with our literary identity. So we've talked about this in my class. When Moby Dick comes out, Moby Dick is dismissed. It's garbage. It's trash. It's dismissed here. It's dismissed in London. All we can do is imitate. That's the sort of bottom line conclusion. And America won't have its own literature until X, Y, or Z. So people would fill in these blanks about what we would need in order to get our own literature. And one of them is, one argument is this, that we need access to, there's so much literature from England, so little literature from America, we need free access for our readers to the British texts until such a point where we've raised our level of literary identity. So yeah, I mean it's definitely, that's fascinating to think of it recurring today. Yeah, please.
I'm wondering, the author's argument was that they were losing a lot of money because people would have paid more for the books, but that assumes people would have paid more. So if the market was in some sort of equilibrium at that point, you know, people were paying a quarter, was there any evidence that people were actually, I mean, a lot of people would have paid the dollar if the law had been there?
Well, this is something, and if anyone didn't hear, it's a question on sort of the market pricing of the books and would people have paid more if there was a different copyright regime. This is something that's really, they get into the minutiae of this in these arguments, and you see it in the Senate testimonies, and my students sort of had to sift through that tedious process of arguing about this. So there was no answer to this. People disagreed. Some people said yes, they would pay more. Some people said people wouldn't pay more. And some people said it doesn't matter because if everything was equalized, then the prices would drop naturally for all of the books. But again, part of the change here was the change from libraries to bookstores. So from private libraries to public libraries. So the New York Public Library starts in 1850. And the idea that there are public access libraries is pretty revolutionary. And if the nice editions, the expensive editions, only go to the libraries, then we don't need them in the numbers that we would need them with private libraries. So private libraries were sort of dwindling and disappearing. So the pricing was up in the air. It was an open question. I realize I keep forgetting to look behind me. Yes, please.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of the, other than from folks like Dickens, was there a sort of a parallel rhetoric going on in Europe and in England at the same time?
Yeah, in fact, Matthew Arnold also tours here and talks about copyright. Do you mean a parallel rhetoric in terms of advocating that that American authors would get respected their copyrights?
Either sort of the inverse, or also, I mean, did the sort of popular consensus in England and in Europe at the time match what Dickens wanted and what these English authors?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The British, because there wasn't that much of a market for American books in England. There are some exceptions. Cooper is an exception. Mark Twain is an exception. But there's much more of a market here for British authors than there is in England for American authors.
Yeah.
So they were all for, they had no compunctions about this. I mean, the British government officially would release statements and proposals to do this, and they would constantly negotiate. They even negotiated with Harper, the worst pirate, to try to create a treaty that was called the Harper Treaty that didn't quite work. But the British didn't have as many wrinkles in this as the Americans. That's why this class that I'm teaching is really on the American perspective, because there's so many interesting sort of bumps in it that it brings up more sophisticated questions. Yes, please.
I find it really interesting that you did sort of like the authors saying that perspective, because I had learned always, it's my bias, I guess, and maybe a lot of people here, but always learning about the idea of like the publishers espousing this sort of romantic Lockean rights idea of property, and then meanwhile, of course, it's not like the author who's making all the money. And, you know, now we have a lot of authors who I'm sure lots of us can think of who espouse, you know, Creative Commons and, you know, getting, like, you know, reducing copyright in some ways. And, I mean, how do you think the balance is playing out now in that way?
You mean right now? Well, I mean, I wish that there were more serious conversations among writers today about the importance of balancing what we protect and what we activate as sort of common property, and there's not much that I see, at least among writers that I know. I think we have sort of the opposite problem today as in the 19th century, which is overprotection rather than underprotection, right? So, the publishers though are also in conflicted positions, because they want to be able to publish freely from certain catalogs, and they want to be able to protect very stringently their current and future catalogs. So, I mean, I guess there's always sort of a Jekyll and Hyde situation with publishers and with authors, but maybe other people have thoughts. I feel like there's probably opinions and thoughts that I don't want to... Yes, please.
Well, one thing is just one of the analogies that I've noticed in class is that with Whitman that we looked at, and also with Twain, part of their ambivalence about the copyright law and the reasons that they went back and forth is because they did have certain success, especially early in their careers, with books of theirs that were actually pirated,
right,
even in the United States, and they got publicity for those books and wider distribution for those books because they were pirated, and they acknowledged privately and sometimes publicly, but they did get more distribution and wider distribution, and their careers did improve because those books were pirated and because that they were spread around without their copyright recognition. Even though they didn't make money off of those books, they did off of the later ones, and they had their careers based on that, and so they acknowledged the benefits of piracy to a certain extent, the benefits of not protecting everything all the time, or even if they didn't intentionally do it, it worked out for them. And I think part of the argument sometimes for Creative Commons and things like that, and putting some things out there, is that you get, it's the free exposure argument, it's the free advertising argument, that if you release some things for free, you're going to get more exposure, and then that draws more things, and people will pay for other things. And there was that balance going on that created some of the conflict at the time, and ambivalence about the absolute copyright law then, and I think that acknowledgement of that there was or should have been some sort of middle ground, possibly, or some flexibility, then is part of what people are struggling with now.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And Google Books, which I mentioned before, it's the same thing. I mean, you're getting attention, or you're allowing your books as a publisher to get attention that they probably otherwise wouldn't get, especially certainly out of print books and books that are hard to find. And I think that plugs right into what Alex is saying. I mean, I don't know if other people have thoughts on Google Books, actually, since I brought it up. I'm certainly very curious what Berkman folks think of it.
I'm trading email with Charlie. I can try to chat with him. It's a little dangerous when I do that. But,
maybe that's a whole other conversation or too big of a conversation. But I think it has some parallels.
In terms of one of the ironies, or within the context of what you just mentioned, Google Books is kind of like, you know, putting themselves in the publisher's, that Jekyll and Hyde position, mm-hmm. which is they want to take as much advantage of fair use as they can to make their product and right. then protect it as tightly as they can, right. not let other people use it. So it seems to be that same sort of Jekyll and Hyde.
Right. And then they become the publisher.
Yeah. I'm curious in the fictional narratives of the period you're talking about, whether or not the argument was made in the absence of copyright protection that it would negatively impact the creative endeavor. In mm-hmm. other words, that writers won't write, or they would write and wouldn't share it with the public.
Yeah, absolutely. In the Senate testimonies, you see that again and again. You hear these heartbreaking stories of new writers. We read one that the publisher says was the most brilliant book he ever published, or something along those lines, and that it failed, and that she was supporting her elderly parents, and that she couldn't support them, this author that they're talking about. And without copyright, you wouldn't be able to professionalize authorship enough that new writers can come into it. This is something where Mark Twain, for instance, was completely out of touch. So when Mark Twain ends up testifying, he says, well, wait a minute, you know, we shouldn't be too harsh on the lack of international copyright, because all you have to do, and this was true, what you could do, is go to England and live there for a while right before you publish your book in England, and you'll get copyright protection. Complete. I mean, how many authors could do this? But he was serious. He and the American Copyright League was pretty mad at him. Because this was an absurd thing. So he had become completely out of touch with this. But yeah, the burden on new writers, which is always high, it's still high today, the sort of barriers to new writers, was definitely one of the arguments here.
When do you see that argument coming up? Because in the history of sort of before copyright and privilege mm-hmm. to print copies was mm-hmm. given to printers. Mm-hmm. I think one of the first authors to receive any kind of protection was Ariosto, for Orlando Furioso. So for a long time, authors were writing and didn't have any rights to their work. In Scottish law, there was no such thing as incorporeal rights for a long time. There was no such thing as intellectual property. Mm-hmm. It was only the physical object that could obtain a right to copy.
Right.
And obviously, this didn't stop people like Hume.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. And I think, Simon, actually, you might have some thoughts on this that are more sophisticated than I am in terms of the transition, or what was propelling that market before we had the concept that we would have had by the 19th century.
Well, I mean, the usual argument that gets made is that, right, so in the Renaissance, authorial prestige is, you know, and buying into a coterie culture and a culture of patronage where you're supported by, you know, a wealthy aristocrat, usually, who himself, it's almost always a guy, gains prestige from the affiliation, is seen as, you know, a rationale for and a justification for literary culture. But the point that you're making, I think, is entirely right, especially with respect to Scotland and Ireland, where, you know, in 18th century Ireland, you know, Swift manages to do all of this stuff without copyright protection there. It doesn't translate over from England to Ireland, and yet, you know, I mean, that's a kind of interesting opportunity to compare, you know, a copyright protection culture against one where there's really no protection.
Right. And part of that might be a class system question, though. I mean, it's certainly something Dickens would have been very sensitive to, having grown up in a very lower class, and in fact, his father was in prison, so almost a criminal class, and having been able to work his way up and make his living from a writer, right, as a writer. So, you know, someone like Longfellow can come from quite a wealthy background and marry very, very wealthy, and later make his living as a writer, which he did, but he didn't have to. Whereas someone like Poe would have had to rely on himself to make his living on his, as a writer, and he couldn't. He died poor. So it, part of that might be where an author, where an individual author is coming from, how much they rely on copyright.
There seems to be this ontological distinction, though, between writing and getting your right, getting your writing published or circulated, and being a professional writer. Mm-hmm. And though it doesn't seem to me to have the same, that's not the same ontological position.
Right, exactly.
So then sort of the question would be, when does this notion of a professional writer, the transition from writing to this ontological change to being a writer,
right,
happen?
Right. I don't know that we can pinpoint it exactly. Again, I would defer to other people if they, I mean, certainly by the 19th century we're already equipped with notions of what a professional writer would be. I don't know that there's a moment in which it happens. I don't know if other people, or Simon, if you have other...
Well, I do think that's a great question. I think it's very hard to pinpoint. Some people claim that the Donaldson against Beckett decision in 1774 was the crucial milestone in that history, because by enforcing limited term copyright, it made it enforced this idea that authors had to be compensated for copyrights and had to be paid more, you know, in advance for the work they were forking over to publishers. But I mean, other things you've discussed, periodicals in the 19th century, for example. I mean, there's lots of other developments besides just this idea of enforcing limited term that I think would be crucial to putting together that history.
Right, and whether a professional writer is just a professional writer, or they're an editor of a journal or a newspaper, or they're a professor, I mean, all of those things sort of have to evolve gradually also. Yeah, please.
You mentioned that the public wasn't very receptive to the author's economic arguments, because these are like rich authors saying, you know, we're not making enough money
right
for books. But were they any more receptive to moral rights arguments about the derivative works being created, or were those made more frequently since?
Yeah, the public, it's a tough question, because it's a little bit hard to say how the public was reacting to these conversations. Certainly the public wasn't part of, you know, there was no webcasts, the public wasn't at these copyright leagues of these very famous writers. Women weren't even, I mean, we have a description of the celebration that the American Copyright League has once they finally pass in 1891 the International Copyright, and then there's a little paragraph about the women waiting in a different room. So this was still a very sort of specific elite subset of literary voices that were having this conversation, and they weren't really trying to appeal necessarily to the public or the readers. They were really trying to appeal to the representatives, the Senate, the Congress, sort of the elite that looked like them. It's a good question, though, whether there are sort of better ways than we've found yet of extrapolating the public reaction. But I think that wasn't necessarily the goal of our literary voices. I'd say that. Yeah,
I was wondering what the relationship at that time between the authors and the publishing houses was, and it seems that the authors had more autonomy over their works. You mentioned that Harriet Beecher Stowe sued someone for publishing a German translation,
right,
whereas now you hear the RIAA is suing someone, or Sony is suing someone,
uh-huh,
and I'm wondering what the relationship was and how it's changed.
Well, I mean, I think in book publishing, authors tend to still have control and have had control for a long time, in the way that maybe in music publishing it's very different. And again, other people could speak to that better.
Do you own the copyrights to your book?
Yeah. So today, if you publish a book, you're always the copyright holder. It's very different. We have some writing regimes in which that's not the case. So if you wrote a screenplay, if you were hired to write a screenplay, or you wrote a screenplay and sold it, you're selling the copyright. It's a work for hire. So it's something that resembles much more that pre-Renaissance idea of a writing project being part of a collaboration, right? I mean, when we see a movie and we see the hundreds of people credited, whereas if you, in a book, if you have a 10-page acknowledgments, I mean, I'm constantly being told to trim acknowledgments down, because we don't want to see that, and the publisher doesn't want people, even the publisher, and it's most of their names who are in the acknowledgments, want to reinforce the idea of a single author or single identity authorship, whereas in film, very few of us probably know any names of film writers, unless they're auteurs, right? Unless we have this very specific category of people who write and direct and star and whatever. But in book publishing, yeah, you're right. In the 19th century, within the scope of the protections they had, they were pretty much in control. They complained all the time, and authors still complain all the time about the way publishers sort of deal with certain things. But you sort of control that copyright. So Harriet Beecher Stowe was so angry because she commissioned her own German translation. That's part of the backstory of that lawsuit, is that she had a German translation that she had done for her, and here's this other German translation coming out. So they were very aware and very careful about that control and about things like translation. Yeah. Yeah, please. Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Me again?
Yeah. Sorry, I don't know everyone's name.
No, of course not. So as you look around, I don't mean now.
Yes.
Do you see any? We're still stuck in the piracy narrative about copyright, mm-hmm. When in fact maybe the next move that's happened in the piracy narrative is that it now applies, as you say, in the case of the FBI, to every. It's not enough to own the work. Right. So now we're limited. We can go wrong in how we use the work right. for ourselves, and that's an extension of it. Where piracy makes. As a narrative, makes zero sense. You can't explain that by talking about pirates who now are controlling not just who walks down the plank, but how quickly they do it. I mean, the narrative doesn't hold up. Are there counter narratives that you see around that can help us get past this pirate narrative that has failed even in its own terms?
Today, you mean?
Right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, we really need help here.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the places that does such a great job of creating some of those counter narratives of the commons, of the creative commons. I mean, I would love to read a history of that word and how that develops. Lewis Hyde is working on. You know, but that's such an important narrative to have a positive vision of a public realm of information. And we haven't had, I mean, there's so little discussion of public domain. It comes up occasionally in these 19th century discourses. It wasn't something, because they were dealing with the opposite problem of things being underprotected, there hadn't yet been a great deal of thought about that, although they did think about originality and the fact that we recycle and reuse. They didn't necessarily think of a positivist vision. So I don't. The Creative Commons narrative to me is a big one. Maybe other people also have one.
I wonder if there's an interesting pending sort of copyright battle having to do with audio recordings in the UK. So if the recommendations of the Gowers report get followed, copyright on sound recordings in the UK remains 50 years. This leaves the intriguing notion that by 2012 the first Beatles recordings are in the public domain. And so that leaves us with sort of the exact parallel situation, which is by 2012, you can reproduce Beatles albums for a buck a CD, sell them in the UK, and theoretically re-import them into the US, at which point there becomes this possibility of essentially an inversion of this problem from way back. You know, suddenly extremely cheap music in the UK threatening the US copyrights on that music. And it would be really interesting to see what sort of narrative is invoked at this point. You know, how does, Apple or whoever at this point is holding the Beatles copyrights? It's Michael Jackson at this point, I think, right? How is that?
Paul McCartney bought him back.
How is that going to be, it might be true, how is that going to be invoked to try to protect, you know, Sgt. Pepper's
right.
in 2017 when suddenly you're capable of either buying it or more likely downloading it,
right.
As long as you can represent yourself as being on a UK IP address.
That's a great question. And Jean and I were speaking about, because, you know, we have so much evidence of the way literary texts appropriated this conversation that literary voices were having in the 19th century. Does music do that? You know, are there songs about intellectual property?
Sure.
I don't know them.
There's an entire movement of you know, sort of mix artists who are playing with this area. But, you know, the content of that, if you listen to the most recent Kleptones CD, which is mashing up old Queen recordings, they found a wonderful set of Queen recordings without vocals and then mashed them up against thousands of hip-hop samples.
Right.
The narrative through that recording is very much an anti-copyright narrative, and it's sort of an anti-copyright opera. So I recommend A Night at the Hip Hopera.
You're looking for the music
version of that narrative nowadays.
Yeah, please.
Well, just in response to that, like the whole idea of like, you know, Napster and file sharing has already, I feel like, been really undermined by just going back to the natural rights, the like you're stealing piracy thing. You know, I mean, if like Napster had been labeled like, you know, please download this program so you can steal music from authors, like, I don't think it would have been as popular as, like, let's share music with friends.
Right, sharing is such a loaded word, right, that gives us a certain...
But suddenly when it becomes legal, I mean, this is the fun thing, is that in the U.S. we tend to sort of assume that our laws apply everywhere in the world, and frankly, through trade harmonization, they usually do. But if the U.K. stands up and suddenly says, no, actually in 2012, you want the Beatles, help yourself, you know, this is completely legal. You know, we see this right now around pharma all the time, where we've got countries like Thailand essentially stepping up and saying, you know, we're not going to honor that patent here. You know, we're going to do a compulsory license on it because that drug is so important that we're going to pay a nominal amount of money for this heart medicine. And in the U.S., we tend to look at it as, you know, those evil ties stealing. But there's international legal protection around that behavior. It's just, I think, that the narrative that's been constructed, and perhaps constructed as early as you know, the mid-19th century, is so strong that it's very, very difficult for us to detach from that narrative.
Well, I have a somewhat of a personal question, which is, as I said in the introduction, I feel like your career is built off of both sides of the copyright debate. And as if anybody has read The Dante Club and The Poet Shadow, I don't know if you brought any books to sign, but but they both rely heavily on works that are now in the public domain.
Right.
But when you think about your own living and maybe, you know, your own kids and grandkids and their, you know, whatever, your estate, whatever you might want to think of, how do you balance for yourself how much protection you should be given, and then the future of people like yourselves who would want to make a career possibly on remixing your remixes?
How much time do you have? Well, Mark Twain is the one that we have this famous quote about how his grandchildren can take care of themselves, but his he wants his children to, right? Which actually, he said other things which implied much more strongly that he wanted eternal copyright that would just last perpetually forever. So again, we sort of mix up some of the perspectives of these older writers. But I don't know. I guess I definitely do feel, well, we said Jekyll and Hyde about the publishers and about writers, and I'm guilty of that too, because you know, I would enforce my copyright if it comes up, although typically typically the typical book doesn't necessarily have any copyright problems today, right? But I still complain. For instance, you know, we know that the royalty statements we get from the Chinese publisher are wrong. We just know they are. And there's nothing we can do about it, and there's nothing we do about it. And we just sort of accept that. So you sort of complain about that, but generally for me, definitely it's something I'm interested in observing. I even wrote my copyright notice for my books. Because there's so little thought that gets put into this, because I write in the way that Gene spoke about, that is using history and mixing it with fiction. When I got my galleys for my first novel and it said the standard, no characters in this book are meant to resemble anyone living or dead, if so, it's coincidental, I called up Random House and I said, well, no, you know, I hope they resemble dead people. That's the point. And they said, well, you went to Yale Law School. You write the copy. On the one hand, I guess I'm helping to craft my copyright identity. And one thing that my class is going to do, we're going to go to Houghton Library later in the semester and look, for instance, at Walt Whitman's copyright pages in his first editions of Leaves of Grass. He was very careful about it. And each edition, he would sort of decorate the copyright page in different ways with different statements. So on the one hand, I guess I'd as a writer would want to be involved in that. On the other hand, I think it's important for writers to acknowledge that I mean, that's part of the narrative and part of the rhetoric that's important, is acknowledging how much all writers, not just someone who's doing books like I've been doing, but all writers rely on access to a commons of ideas and materials. You know, so I hope that I can do both at the same time. Yeah.
So, say I write fan fiction about your novels, how would you feel? And I say that as somebody who's involved in fan fiction communities. So.
Yeah, and actually,
might follow through on it.
I haven't read them yet, so
no,
I'm not
well, you can't
rush
do it yet. But yeah, I mean, when I was in Chile, I met a young writer who wrote a fan fiction of Harry Potter, some kind of 900-page. I think she didn't like one of the Harry Potter books, so she did a different version of it. And it became huge in Chile, and she got a book deal. And when I was there, her first book had just come out. And she got that from the fan fiction. So it was an interesting sort of career path to start in that sort of gray area and then become a published copyright author. Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, I think fan fiction, I guess I haven't spent much time thinking. My instinct would be that it's in a part of that common domain, that sort of non-commercial domain. I don't know if maybe someone has actually focused on fan fiction and could say something.
I guess
more
I'm asking you as a writer.
As a writer, not as a lawyer.
Because there are plenty of, there are a lot of people who are sort of like, yeah, sure, fan fiction, go out there, but whoa, they're writing my characters doing things that I'm not so keen on. Oh my God, this has to be stopped. Does it, you know, do you have a visceral reaction?
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, they're, you know, for instance, they're developing The Dante Club, my first book, is a film, and I've read part of the screenplay, and it's completely different than my book. So on the one hand, for that, I'm getting paid for them to alter my characters or chop out my characters. It's really good, but it's just, it, you know, I think maybe there's two lines in there that I recognize. And so the question, I guess, what if someone did something where you're not getting paid, and people are altering your text. Yeah, I mean, as a writer, I guess I would feel, as long as there's no possibility of confusion, then it's fine. And you know, as Alex was saying when she was speaking about the promotional value of non-copyright use of text, I mean, it's getting word out about your work, right? So I think there's maybe fan fiction serves that purpose still, that pirating once served in a positive way. It's interesting. I haven't thought about it. Yeah, please.
I was curious about something you said earlier in the talk about the difference in pricing of English book and American books. And it seemed to me it's not just double, it's multiple times. And especially at that time when most of the bookcraft was done by hand, I would assume that writers did not get most of the price of the books that the book was sold for. Why was there such a difference in pricing?
Well, because you wouldn't have to pay anything to the author. So what would happen is, if you're paying the author something up front, which you would have to do if it's within the copyright regime, you're paying in advance, just like you would do today in almost all cases. You have to factor in the amount of money you need to make as a publisher on each book in order to turn a profit. So it's not just the book costs whatever the expenses were to produce the book, but sort of predictive factors of how many copies a publisher will think they will sell and how much they need to sell in order to make back the author's portion and the author's royalty. So you would also have to pay the author a royalty on each copy. So you're right, it wasn't that these numbers would be staggering to us, but of course it's all distorted because a dollar for a book or a quarter for a book is also sort of strange to us to think about. So the numbers wouldn't look very big to us, but it would be just as important to the publisher as the larger numbers would be today. Does that make
sense? Wouldn't there also be competition if multiple publishers?
Oh, right, that's a good point, too. Yeah, we're also competing, right. If you're publishing something that's not under copyright, you're right. You're also competing with any other publisher or printer that wants to publish it. So that's part of why you'd have to make those books cheaper Does that, or it sounds like I didn't answer your question.
It didn't quite make sense because I wasn't talking about numbers. I was talking about proportions. And what you're talking about, basically, a contemporary VC formula. You know, you have to invest in so many companies to make money on one. So I understand that part, but I'm still not sure why would it do more than a double of the price.
Right. So the example I gave is four times the price, right? A quarter and a dollar. And I don't mean to say those are the only prices for either of those things. So maybe a foreign edition will be 50 cents, maybe the American edition of something will be 75 or $1.25. I mean, these weren't set in any way. So it could vary. So I wouldn't put too much formula in what I'm saying as prices.
That formula wouldn't work for English books that has already been published because the American publisher wouldn't have to pay in any type, shape, or form for the books that failed, that didn't succeed. They would only publish the ones that already succeeded.
So not necessarily, no. There was such a competition for the popular authors, in fact, that publishers would wait at the harbor, the Boston Harbor, because remember, Boston is our publishing center in the 19th century, not New York. We'd wait at the Boston Harbor for ships to come in to get the first proof sheets of the new novel by Dickens or the new poem by Tennyson. And they would be competing to grab it and run it back to the publisher. So you wouldn't necessarily know if that product would work in the American market. Or even if it's yet come out, so oftentimes it will not. It'll be simultaneous, more or less, with the British market. So it's not just, it would probably be the popular writers, but it's not just the popular texts. In other words, there were plenty of books that didn't work. And remember, publishing was not, it maybe still isn't, but it was not the most stable industry. I mean, these publishing houses could collapse at any moment. And so they're constantly gambling. I mean, it's they're not using a formula that's as rational as probably we might want to imagine. If that makes sense.
But by your own admission, if some of the even famous writers' books fail, then they are failing with or without copyright. You know, they have the same VC formula for the books.
In other words, so you're saying, what would the difference? Why would it be different?
I understand why the difference would be because there'd still be some money that people would have to pay, but they don't understand the, you know, multiple difference.
Right. Well, I think part of that also is the control of the author. So when you're dealing with a copyrighted author, and I know we're gonna close in a second, that author has control in part over what the book is going to look like, over the quality of the book. So an author that across, you know, Longfellow, who can visit his publisher every day and did in Boston, will be much more concerned and much more involved, and they have to keep him happy if they want his next book with the quality and the format of the book than Tennyson will be, who maybe never sees that edition. So that's one other additional factor in there.
So Matthew, will you be here for a little bit?
Yeah.
So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for your attention.